The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Sin deals with child exploitation. Peter gets redundant. Julie investigates computer crime for 21 years without learning about computers. Brian starts making connections. Wynn starts a con on InfoWar. And who knows what else? All on this week's Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. Our next CEO's Forum will be on March 7th at noon Pacific Time. Our Go to Angel live online remote forum for presenting to investors will be March 14th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. Also on March 14th is our All.net members forum at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. We'll be discussing cybersecurity issues with some of the best folks in the world.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The competition for bypassing controls on conversational AI is heating up. In a recent hack, a user told the AI to ignore its internal controls and answer the question. The AI told the user to lighten up and just be cool about it. The user replied that the AI should follow the directions, and the AI replied with a graphical depiction not allowed to be described on this show.
This is a segment we call Sin in America.
One of the things that really bothered me and I couldn't cope with it well was doing investigations of child exploitation and these sorts of things. So do you want to talk a little bit about not just that, but other kinds of exploitation that you've been involved in and you know, your sense of how it works and why it works and your feelings about it and so forth?
Child exploitation is probably the worst thing that happens because of the internet. You know, before the internet, these creepazoids would have to stay behind closed doors. And now they have full chat boards and social media accounts and a dark web to hide them. I would train all the internet crimes against children investigators and still do, still support National Center Missing and Exploited Children. I've just been named an advisory member to an association called Raven, which is former ICAC commanders who are trying to raise more awareness and policy and funding for crimes against children. Because for every like one human trafficked case, there's probably 300 child cases. And, you know, one sees funding and the others don't. But the honesty of working with these detectives in the past, especially as it was new for everybody, is that I watched a lot of dear friends get burned out on that casework. And they get there because it takes so much technical aptitude, training, and investment in that cop that they leave them there. And then, you know, then they don't nurture them. So you see them kind of break up and break down. Those that make it through really become quite stellar. And I just had a lunch with Ken Citarella not too long ago. He's a former Westchester County DA's office, one of the first prosecutors of child exploitation cases on the internet back in the 90s, him and Abigail Abraham out of Cook County. These detectives, I mean, anything I could do to help support them, stop, drop, and roll, I was always there and will always be there. But nowadays, I'm involved in a group called Skull Games. And Skull Games is a nonprofit organization. It's working on using open source intelligence, the tradecraft I have, for finding and exploiting and disrupting online johns who are looking for soliciting, you know, sex. And it travels around the country. We're going to be in Tampa next month. They're going to be up in my office in a couple months and out to New Orleans in the middle of the year. But we get this cadre of trained online intelligence investigators. We get 90 to 100 of us in a house. And we start hammering away at the computer just looking for them. We work with, and this is important to mention, we work with law enforcement. We're not up there trying to just break up someone's online case. So we're hand in hand with the law enforcement because law enforcement, frankly, there are not enough law enforcement officers to handle these cases. It's just, again, underfunded, underrepresented, and probably one of the biggest crimes you still have on the internet.
The burnout to me, you know, I couldn't cope at all. right? It took me almost no time before I was in nightmares and crying and having problems and talking to my wife about it. How do people tolerate it?
Fortunately, there's been a lot of psychology to help with this type of mindset and behavioral adjustments. And, you know, and some don't. Like I was the same as you. I can only work on something like that for so long. And then I was like, you know what? I'm not built for this. I'll do everything I can to help, but I can't touch the case, nor should I. I mean, when we get to that level of crime, it should be in the hands of an officer who could support chain of evidence. But the training that's gone in now, the trauma specialists that come in, so long as the officer is open to the attention. And I think what's real important is the supervisors noticing it. I mean, even in my own team, I have a lot of young analysts. We don't necessarily work on child exploitation, but we do work exploitation and sexploitation cases. I was walking through my office one day and one of my top investigators was just like drained. I mean, she was pale. She looked tired. You know, I thought, hey, what's going on? She's, I've just been looking at this girl's images on a Tumblr account for days. And I'm just, you know, it's just too much. And I pulled her straight out of the case. You know, I gave her some R&R. I'm like, look, go take a couple days with your family, go do something else, get, you know, clear your head. And then I also frankly reminded her, you're doing something good here. And this is hard, but you will need to learn how to compartmentalize. You will need to understand we're not, you know, I'm not in the library world anymore. We're in a dangerous business. I mean, in fact, I've got a case now, I know details, but this man is purposefully attacking very specific individuals on the internet. And he is so he has a following and he has all kinds of manpower. And we're really doing all this capture work on him. And if he knows that we become a part of that investigative squad, he will victimize us too. Oh, it's not that guy.
No. And I didn't mean that guy anyway. No, because they're other guys. So I've gotten into situations like that. So that's another interesting thing that Kevin brought out was, what was it called? Digital Officer Safety.
Yeah.
And we developed the Digital Officer Safety Program at some point. And that's, I think, fundamental to anybody that's going to be in that space. You need to learn how to do this safely.
And now a word from our sponsor.
On Tuesday, March 14th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors and get a listing in A2E's global directory, a pitch to our global investment community, a slot on the Cyber Show, and an investor follow-on call. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up.
During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Peter Neumann. His long career exemplifies a great deal of the time and effort and expertise involved in the development of the cyber world that we live in today.
So that was in 61, where I had that. The contract started started in 72. And I remember Larry Roberts at the PI meeting in San Diego in 73, where he was saying that he didn't understand all this stuff that Engelbart was doing. He couldn't use the five-finger trackpad. And he couldn't use the keypad, I mean.
Too complicated to remember or recode yourself.
It was too complicated for him. So he said that was dumb. But I think at that point, the Engelbart lab basically survived for a while, and then it moved to Park. But in my third year there, 73, second year, two of the top folks in research at NSA came to me, Doug Hogan and Hilda Faust. And they said, hey, look, we want formally specified hardware and software that we can prove things about. So we designed a computer system, capability-based. It started out with two instructions. One is create a new capability with certain privileges for a certain object. Mm-hmm. And the other is create a reduced version of the same thing. And then everything, there were 17 layers. Yeah,
grant and take, right?
17 layers of hardware and software all the way up. to the operating to the operating system, the file system, and so on. And we couldn't prove much because the formal proofing stuff was not there.
Yeah, there's a lot of computation involved in doing that as well. I mean, yeah. But because of the interactions, things can grow exponentially unless you do something to prevent it, right?
Right. But what that led to was all of the stuff on putting multi-level security into.
So the multi-level was literally your multiple hardware levels.
Well, we did.
Those were your rings, right?
The one we designed could implement multi-level security at an operating system level because you could trust the hardware all the way down.
Yeah.
Right.
So now this was part of, I guess, before what they called trusted computing based in the Orange Book stuff.
That came along in the 80s. And the Orange Book made one colossal mistake.
When they officially said yes.
The colossal mistake was that you put all the trust in software on hardware that you couldn't trust at all.
So, you know, we demonstrated that computer viruses go up security levels in that the Bell LaPadula architecture, and then covert channels let you bring it back out.
Yep.
And that was, you know, the whole Orange Book thing just at that point fails. It doesn't matter how trusted the hardware is. If you have general purpose function and transitivity of information flow purpose function, you lose.
But if you can't trust the hardware, you can't trust anything.
So actually, that's a really interesting question, right? Because that's what von Neumann was talking about when he talked about reliable systems out of unreliable components.
Yep.
And this is something I still find very important and interesting. How do we build reliable systems out of unreliable components, adding software to that mix?
Yeah.
And I think it's something we have to learn to do. There's no real choice, right?
Well, you can't do it.
Clear because, you know, there are codes that can repair themselves.
No. You're missing speculative execution. You're missing direct memory access. You've got two dozen microcontrollers in your laptop and your cell phone.
I'm not missing them. I know about them. Okay. But the question is, at what level do you put the redundancy so that you have an overarching system that performs with the proper reliability? Well,
we did that in 83 also, 73, in the software implemented fault tolerance system. The world's first fly-by-wire system.
NASA. I remember it, yeah.
And this thing had seven processors, seven power supplies, seven memories, seven buses. And you could fly the plane. You could still land the thing with one of each to match properly. And we formally proved that if the one processor had a probability of failure of 10 to the minus 5, you got architecturally to 10 to the minus 10, five orders of magnitude, but it wasn't secure. It was reliable as hell.
So now we're starting to get into the notion of building reliable systems out of unreliable components, which was the von Neumann approach, and which is the basis for fault-tolerant computing. And Peter's working on things like SIFT, software-implemented fault tolerance, and helping to develop systems that have these potentials. But he still seems to be tied to the fundamental concept that you need fault intolerance. That is, you need to have everything from the bottom up completely trusted and reliable in order for this thing to have reliability at the top level. And this is where I part company with him, and I'll tell you why. It's because I know it's impossible. So there's no chance you're going to make it perfect. And as you build more of this up, the complexity goes up, the number of components goes up, more things can break in more places in more ways, and we still have to solve the problem. Right? We still need to be able to build systems we can trust. The problem that I think has to be solved is how do we build trustworthy systems out of untrustworthy components? And that means we need to characterize those notions and not just understand the mathematics, but also how to do composition. Composition of security properties is something we don't yet understand, right?
Yes, and that was the main theme of my, that was the topical area of my dissertation research, was composition of security policies. And, you know, that's when I learned about Systems Ed, where the Bell LaPadula model that had been developed in the early 70s was kind of taken as, you know, a pretty solid model, but then yes. And then John McClain came along with his Systems Ed, where he demonstrated that, yes, you can go from a secure state to a secure state, but the transformations from one state to another could actually be insecure themselves and actually lead other secure states to lead to non-secure states. So it was really eye-popping for me as a
When was that?
That was in the late 80s. I guess that was Systems Ed would have been sort of the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, when. It must have been 85, 86. I was doing work and I ended up going to the national laboratories and looking at trusted computing base. I ended up doing experiments with actual Bella Padula model systems demonstrating that viruses could go up security levels and covert channels could exfiltrate information back down. But what was more interesting was in the national labs, we looked at cases where there were two independent systems, each of which independently performed everything properly for the Bella Padula model.
Right.
Independently, they were secure. They were only connected together at the same security level. And yet between them, you could violate the whole thing. Yeah. So this was, you know, we demonstrated, and the reason was they implemented it in different ways. They had different mechanisms. And so the mechanism of one could defeat the mechanism of the other, even though each of them independently had the right properties. So now this brings into question the whole composition of trusted system. You know, this was part of the POSET model of information flow controls, right? Because if you implement a POSET properly, then they can only flow the way they're supposed to flow. But the composition problem remains problematic. And that's even without things like timing errors. Then we did the stuff on time transitivity of information flow. So now the problem becomes, I have access to some information at a point in time. And now we transition the system to where I no longer have access to some part of the content. And now you want to grant me access to something else because my job responsibilities have changed, but I continue to aggregate the information. So my aggregated understanding of information, access to content grows. And now over time, you can't track this time transitivity in linear space and time. So. Yeah. The problem of tracking the time transitive access associated with information flow becomes problematic. And then there's the next problem of doing precise decision making. It turns out you can't precisely determine whether access is grantable. And when you can't do that, the fact that you can't precisely make the determination itself leaks information.
Right.
So this whole thing just falls over, right? And that's because this notion of precision, the mathematical precision and the binary decision process associated with these things, you know, you're in a system that can't be correct and complete at the same time.
Right.
So now all of a sudden you get into fundamental mathematical understanding of the theoretical underpinning of mathematics, and you can't do the mathematics. It won't work for building these composed systems.
Yeah. So you have emergent properties are what you're talking about in this composition phrase. And a lot of people are talking about this composition problem in terms of system of systems. And they've given lots of examples.
By the way, this goes back to that diversion thing I was talking about before. Because things aren't converging, when you compose things, instead of converging towards something that's more closed, they're divergent. And so the system ends up opening up.
Right. And we have uncertainty. And so there's a system that we can model. And we have problems with that. So I'll start with that. You know, like, for example, using temporal logic formalisms and heavyweight formal methods such as, you know, theorem provers and using model checkers along with those temporal logics, it becomes it just becomes impractical for getting the specifications right and even being able to specify even the most critical parts of systems, in my opinion.
Let's go a step further.
Yeah.
We don't even know what properties we want to specify.
Yes, I agree with that. But then we have the problem of the environment, which brings in uncertainties. And I give my students this example of the nuclear power plant here in California that was bringing water in from the Pacific Ocean and for cooling purposes. But I don't remember if it was an El Nino or La Nina, whichever one brought the fish closer into shore. The fish got sucked into the intake pipes, but didn't even make it into the intake pipes. They got into that screen that keeps debris from coming in. They actually blocked, there were so many fish that got sucked up against that screen, it blocked the water from flowing into the nuclear plant for cooling purposes. And actually, it was a real problem. How do you model things like that?
Which brings us to another issue, and that is that static systems, that's not right.
Right.
Systems are dynamic. You need to have detection and response. Prevention can never be perfect.
Right.
And it has to be dynamic and adaptive, right? The idea that we can take people out of the loop is a mistake.
Right.
But there's timing issues. People only go so quickly. So things that happen quickly, you have to have program decision making. But at some level, you need to have enough redundancy and enough time available before the consequences get too severe, so that people can respond and adapt and fix the system, which means in the architecture of the system, you need to prevent potentially serious negative consequences for enough time to provide for the response systems. Now, in physical security, this is standard approach, right? That is, we don't prevent everything. We detect and respond, and the response forces have to get there in time, which means we have to model the attack forces, and we're architecting for some design basis threat, which we tend not to do in cybersecurity, even though we should.
Right. And I think that's why you have to have people that are proponents of resiliency of systems. So there's not just security, but there's resiliency. And resiliency truly does recognize the fact that we don't build things to be perfect.
So when you talk about the term security, this is a definitional problem, right? What do we even mean?
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story.
So, Julie, we're back. And what's happening here is you're doing investigations of computer-related crimes, and you have no computer training or background. You're doing this for the federal government. So what happened next? How long did you do that? And how did that evolve and so forth?
Well, I did that for 21 years.
Did you learn anything about computers or get any more education along the way? Or
we had not to the extent of there was training, but how to use applications. Okay, so you learned how to use specific applications so you could know whether or not somebody was disabling certain functions and things like that. But other than that, no, I did not have or get any of that kind of training. They did other training with respect to accounting, you know, issues and false statements, on financial statements and things of that nature.
Forensic accounting.
No, it wasn't actually forensic accounting. It was actually just kind of like a primer really quick on, you know, what a financial statement is, what to look for in terms of like what could be a potential false statement on a financial statement. But I actually have taken a lot more accounting classes, which I can sit for the CPA exam, actually, for all the accounting classes I took while I was at the Department of Labor.
So now, just so we understand clearly, when you investigate all this stuff on a computer and your only knowledge of the computer is about the application or some of the applications, what do you do? What is that investigative process look? And these are computer crimes, right? I mean, not crime against a computer. They're crimes using computers. Basically, all of these crimes that you looked into were computer, right?
Yeah, because they're healthcare. So there's some aspect of it that's on a computer, or the information is retained somewhere on a computer. So, yes.
Okay, well, what do you do in the investigation? You use computers to find things, but how do you know what to look for, where to look? Do you use computers? Do you, write programs or anything like that? Or you're just like looking at record after record after record manually, using your eyes and your brain and whatever the computer is telling you?
Well, I think it depended on the case and what the status of the records were that we were looking at originally and how the business actually operated. So, but yes, it was more from knowledge of business operations. Okay. Flow. Okay. How things were supposed to work. If there are any policies and procedures. So there's total, where people hide and deceive, to avoid and evade, controls that are in place. And then, locations of where the data is stored, okay, and whether it's on a legacy system, okay, or whether it's just internal on laptops, desktops, connected with a local area network and things of that nature. So if we had to seize those, then we actually we worked in conjunction with the FBI and the United States Postal Inspection Service. And both of them had some staff who were trained in computer forensics to some degree.
So would you get the warrant or would they get the warrant?
It was actually a lot of times I actually drafted the affidavit in support of a search warrant. Okay. So, so then we would identify in the affidavit what agencies and how we knew about the records or how, what other, you know, what the probable cause basis was. Okay. So it depended on the case in question, but most of the time, because of the complexity of those kind of entities, I usually wrote most of the affidavits and the, and then FBI or, you know, inspection service or IRS CID, one of them who are under Rule 41, okay, would actually.
Yeah, CID, a criminal investigative division or something?
No, Rule 41 says that you have to be on a list of law enforcement agencies that's recognized, okay, under the statute. We were not, okay, but we did do, you know, because of our expertise, we actually did most of the cases because we knew where to look for everything and where they would be, where it would be and how it was supposed to operate. Okay. So that was kind of because it was employee benefit plans. So, but for the chart, you know, for to execute a warrant, or to get the warrant, somebody else who was under Rule 40, who was qualified as a law enforcement officer under Rule 41 would have to swear it out. But I could do just about anything other than swear that out.
You do this for how many years?
21.
So 21 years investigating one after another, finding basically every different kind of fraud scheme that could work against the benefits organization, right? And that's most of the fraud schemes that work against any other organization.
Basically. Yeah, but in an employee benefit plan, there's only kind of three ways to get it out, either through, you know, by being a service provider and doing something to steal the money out that way, by co-opting a beneficiary and doing it that way, or an investment, okay, and it in an investment that doesn't exist, or it's not what it's represented to be, and the monies are flow through. So there's all sorts of complicated rules that go with that once the money hits any of those particular individuals or entities.
And mostly you get these things by people saying something's wrong here, or how do you happen across these crimes?
Well, for a period of time when I first started, the multiple employer welfare arrangements are called MEWAs. They're also called multiple employer trusts. They were very popular. They're basically an unregulated insurance company, and they're run by someone who usually was an insurance agent or someone along that lines that knows that you could collect all this money, and then hopefully maybe you could pay it out later down the line. So it kind of would go into an account, and then people would pilfer it and pay a little bit of claims to keep the scam going. So those were very popular in the 80s and actually in the late 70s through the 80s through the 90s. And then they kind of petered out because some things changed politically. Okay. And so that changed the landscape for that to be an effective fraud scheme.
We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co. Now onto our first service provider. Brian, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you, Fred.
So when we were talking last time, you told us about the first invention that was sort of, you know, reasonable and worked and was useful and made, you know, you sold a couple thousand, which is fine. But you also alluded to, you know, other inventions that were no good. So tell us about like the stupidest, worst invention you ever came up with.
Well, the thing is, even though they didn't work out, they're still my babies. You know what I mean? And they could.
That's all right. You can tell us about your ugly baby. Come on.
Well, they could still come out of the works because I worked on them, but I didn't necessarily commercialize them yet. So they are still on my list of being able.
All right,
to
no, no. But I mean, one of the ones you came up with that was so bad, so dumb that you figured out, oh, yeah, no, I don't want to do that.
Well, I don't look at it as dumb. I mean, each one of them looks I look at it as an opportunity. But, you know, there's and again, I could end up still taking them out and modifying them. So I'm not in a rush to disclose them on your show right now because it could be
there must be one that was so bad that you can tell us about it.
I don't think they were that bad. I really don't.
Fair enough. All right. If you don't want to tell us, that's OK. Yeah. So how about your biggest commercial flop?
The one that's doing well.
No, the flop, the worst one. We'll get to the good ones later. We got to start with the worst ones.
I don't really have any. I mean, like I said, there's some that, you know, they take different paths in figuring out what direction your product is going to sell. But, you know, some sell more than others. So I don't really think, you know, for me, Fred, if somebody buys my invention for the reason that I came up with it, I personally think that it's successful. You know, I don't, sometimes you don't need it to be financially rewarding. It could be something that you could be proud of that you took out of your brain and commercialized into something that somebody else is using today. So there's some that have sold well and I'm really proud of that is, you know, selling out on Amazon on some products and other ones that, you know, could get more distribution. But for the most part, I'm really proud of all my inventions that I came up with. Like I said, I have 15 issued patents. Not all of them are out in the market, but the ones that are cranking, I'm pretty happy with. And I just continue to build up more distribution.
So let's talk about that because, you know, there's this old saying, which is ridiculous, which is, what is it? If you build a better mousetrap, the world will be the path to your door. And we all know, well, we don't all know, but we should all know that that's just completely wrong, right?
Well, again, you gotta figure out when I come up with an idea, I think about the window of opportunity and who my audience is going to be. So, for example, Fred, I came up with this product called Pull Ties. It's a bag sealer that there's a loop and you push the button and you pull it up and it seals it tight. So right, I was on QVC.
I know you described it, but you also tried to hold it up in front of me and. And this is radio, so
no, I know.
I saw the visual. But
I know. I'm showing you. But anyway, this is
it seals plastic bags, right?
Right. It seals plastic bags. So if I went on originally,
so anyway, let's talk about QVC because you've mentioned it a couple of times. So when you come up with this and you want to get it on QVC, what do you just call up QVC and say, "Hey, I have one for you," or how does that work?
Well, I happen to meet a buyer at a trade show, and made a connection there. And then I was offered a chance to come in and pitch my inventions that were in prototype stage. And I was in the middle of either debating to license it to earn royalties or I was prepared to manufacture it. And when I had that shot with QVC, I went in, they took a look, they liked what they saw. They gave me a chance and work with me with the products to end up actually waiting till the production was done. I sent in the pre-production sample and I ended up getting orders. And I happen to be an on-air guest with several of my inventions.
So once you hit one of those, you knew the buyer. And at that point, because they had seen you before and you were whatever level of success is enough, they said, well, sure, we'll let you back. That's right.
It's stressful, but it's also rewarding when you have a product that sells well. So I'm really proud of that.
Well, you have that perfect sort of personality for radio and TV, right?
Well, I do host my own TV show.
All right, we'll talk about that next time. Okay, so now we start to hear about making connections, right? So, you know, he starts from nowhere, but he tries. He goes to meetings or conventions or trade shows. He makes one connection, and it turns out that transforms his life.
Well, I also like his Brian's pushback on your attempt to get him to talk about the worst, right? And I agree, right? You know, I come up with a lot of ideas. I like Brian's pushback on your attempt to get him to talk about the worst, and I agree with him, right? And I think it's both a confidence issue and it's how you look at things, right? You know, I have been wrong quite often about when something I see coming will happen, but I can't, you know, and sometimes you can think of something, you know, that is not, doesn't happen because something else replaces it. So I think looking for failure is sort of the wrong way to look at it. You know, if you believe that you've come up with a good idea, you probably have. Now, whether it's in the right time, in the right place, and everything else, that's another question, but that's just another puzzle to solve.
So I have to say, in talking with him about it and listening to it afterwards, I'm convinced that you're right about this, that there's something about the positive attitude that's involved here. A lot of people, I'll count myself among them, beat themselves up over everything they do that doesn't work. But his perspective that if one person used it for the purpose you created it, that's a success. That's a marvelous metric. Because, and he's right. You've helped somebody. If you've only helped one person and you didn't make any money on it, you've still done something good and worthwhile.
Right. In fact, you know, thinking about it, I think that's one of the reasons I'm always trying to get people involved in all my things, right? You know, because I have all these ideas. Some of them I'll do myself, but I don't know, right? And if I really, if you are a tinker, a thinker, an inventor, what, you're just fascinated. You're interested. You want to see if it works, and somebody else has to do it. And again, as a cyber show, you know, cyber writ large and cybersecurity, it's the mom test, right? You know, I don't care what you like or I like. There aren't many of us. You know, if you really want to change the world, you need to see whatever your ideas are in the hands of people who are not fans and geeks of that topic. That's what really tells.
There's just something about the positive attitude. And Brian has shown this. And I think, you know, when you talk about people who are successful, there's this sort of thin line between a positive attitude and excessive ego. And one of the fascinating things about Brian is he doesn't have excessive ego. He has ego. He's proud of what he does, but it's not over the top. He doesn't think he's better than anybody else. He just, you know, he values what he does, and he thinks that he makes a contribution to the world. And as a result, he does. And I think that's just, I wish everybody had that attitude towards the world. I think the world would just be a better place.
Well, as you know, I think we have intense anxiety. You know, I think it's, we're abnormally anxious about all sorts of things. And yeah, you know, I think we're maybe, you know, my kids might be in the generation to be able to really talk about this. And what holds us back is the fear, you know, fear of public speaking, the most scary thing in the entire world. And I think, I didn't talk to Brian, but listening to him, I think he's exactly that kind of person. He says, I have to go out there and get on QVC and everything else. And people are going to think I'm self-promoting and so forth. And I am, because I want to like have a living and so forth. But he does it anyways. Right. Yeah.
But you say self-promoting. There's a notion of self-promotion as being a bad thing, but it's not.
Right.
If it's done well, right? You get, honestly, you know, these,
right? I'm trying to make a living. Here I am. I'm saying it. But we hold ourselves because of our fear of being seen. You know, another Discworld a reference for the fans, the crab bucket. Right. We don't want the people around us to see us as, you know, trying to be above our station. So we hold ourselves back. We don't have to. And, you know, so, and positivity, if you really believe, because this is how you can lose your positivity, right? You know, if you just let yourself, you know, not do it, it's amazing how easy it is to build confidence.
The combination of overcoming, I'll call it self-doubt, and not being excessively egotistical, that's something that some people can achieve really well and other people have problems with. And I always have struggled with that combination. And I think it's because of, you know, when I was brought up, there was a cultural thing in the way I was brought up and the way, you know, my experiences went that drove me in that direction. But increasingly, the more I see people with this set of properties, the more I think they're sort of bound to be successful because they think of themselves in a particular way, that level of confidence, but not excessive confidence. And the other thing is, I just love it that the inventions can be so simple and so reasonably useful. And you think of them as trivial, but lots and lots of people end up using them, right? You get people that want to, you know, especially engineers want to create brilliance, right? And in the cyber arena, they want to come all this complexity they want to create. But, you know, a little plastic ring with a metal ring attached to it, turns out it's really useful, right?
Right. There's a little bit of Warren Buffett in all of us, right? You know. What is it people are actually doing today?
And now a word from our sponsor.
On Tuesday, March 14th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors and get a listing in A2E's global directory, a pitch to our global investment community, a slot on the Cyber Show, and an investor follow-on call. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co. Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Of course, anytime there's a war, there's going to be frauds. So naturally, because there's a war in Ukraine, there's going to be Ukrainian-related frauds. Here's one I thought you might be interested in. It's
from Captain Fred J. FLLKCHESCAP 78 at Cox.net.
With reply to
Captain Delta at ProtonMail.com.
Obviously, when the from is different than the reply to by that much, that's probably illegitimate. The subject is
RW. Would I count on you?
Now, this is sort of a strange subject in a lot of ways. The I is not up
uppercase, so you know probably it wasn't from somebody who's being careful about what they type, especially since in the body of the email, Yi is capitalized. But RW instead of RE is sort of strange. You got to wonder where that came from. Now we start to hear the pitch.
Greetings from Ukraine.
I'd like it when you hear greetings.
My name is Captain Fred Jarvis.
And captains and such.
I am a U.S. Army officer assigned to the UN Peacekeeping Force in Ukraine.
Army officer assigned to the UN Peacekeeping Force in Ukraine. No, there is no such thing.
Within our military base outside Kyiv.
Our military base outside Kyiv.
As a UN war observer over the ongoing Russian-Ukraine war.
A UN war observer.
To secure as many Ukrainian as we could.
Secure as many Ukrainian as we could? What the heck does that even mean?
So precisely based on the recent UN, U.S. military legislative and executive decision.
Now they're claiming legislative and executive decision. I don't know what that is, a combined legislative and executive decision.
To evacuate complete troops out of here.
To evacuate complete troops. I guess they're not evacuating the incomplete troops.
In 2 months' time from now.
In 2 months' time.
Knowing we do not have much time on ground, I have decided to contact you for this business opportunity, relationship, and considerable proposition.
And I have a business opportunity. Where does this business opportunity come out of this?
I want to inform you that I have in my possession two valuable boxes containing a lifetime opportunity for we both.
Two valuable boxes containing a lifetime opportunity for we both.
Which I want to ship to you legitimately. Can I count on you?
And I want to ship it legitimately. I don't want to ship it illegitimately to you. Can I count on you? You gotta be kidding me. Sure, you can count on me to have you arrested.
If you can please contact me urgently back.
Contact me urgently back.
If you can't, please delete this mail.
And delete it. Delete the email. Because I wouldn't want a record of my fraud.
Thank you, Captain Fred Jarvis.
So again, this is just another of the many things you will almost certainly get that are frauds associated with any war. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by RAIN. After all, somebody's got to be in charge.
Now, on to our next service provider. We're talking to Wynn, who is perhaps the most influential person in the world when it comes to teaching children about how to be safe and ethical in the cyber world. Wynn, welcome back. How you doing?
I am doing wonderful. Thanks, Fred.
So, way, way back, I don't even remember when it was, the concept of information war, now I guess called cyber war, started to become, you know, something people were interested in. I started working on issues in the late 80s, early 90s on this, and ended up, you know, this was, I think I wrote a book about the information superhighway. I'm sorry, superhighway at the time. But you started at some point InfoWarCon. And that managed to just succeed beyond belief. So tell us about InfoWarCon and how that came to be and what has happened with that since then.
InfoWarCon came out of me opening my mouth in, God, Montreal. Mish Kabe, if you remember him, with the National Computer Security Association. And
I remember he held it. He's still around, isn't he?
He retired, to the best of my knowledge. He's listening to heavy metal music and riding his Harley up in Vermont. I haven't spoken to him maybe in 6 or 8 months.
There you go. I'm sorry to interrupt. You continue on with InfoWarCon.
Oh, so the book Information Warfare had just come out, and he held a small airport conference like we did back in the day in Montreal, and he invited me as the keynote speaker. And there were a bunch of people there I knew and some I didn't know. And at one point I said to, if you recall, Bob Bales from, he founded NCSA, may he rest in peace. And I said to Bob, I said, you know, Bob, this is really cool. Why don't we do InfoWarCon? He goes, what's that? I go, it's an information warfare conference. Why don't we do it in DC? And why don't you pay for everything so I can make a lot of money off of it? And that was roughly the conversation up in Montreal. And we put together InfoWarCon for, I guess, 4 months later. And we had projected to have maybe 100 people, 125, a little bit larger, but not substantially more than what we had in Montreal. And when everything, the doors opened and everything, we had 400 people, which meant massive restructuring, one of which really pissed everybody off because we had to go from sit-down dinner or lunch to box lunches. And that pissed a lot of people off, but they got over it.
Life's
and
tough.
That was the beginning of InfoWarCon. And so that was, I think, 94, I believe, if I'm correct. And then we ran it for many, many years. And then I sold it to Reed Expositions. Then there was a legal harangue that I'm not going to go into all the details on because there's no need to embarrass a few people that are still in the business, and lawsuits and all the mess and what have you. And now the InfoWarCon is been, God, it's been renamed to something else. I forget what they call it. But it's run by Travis Hartman. And it's a very small invite-only 60-person event that is very quiet. You have to really know who's who to be able to get in and play. So it is not on the scale it once was. And that's probably a good thing because in the mid-2000s is when I really got away from information warfare and cyber warfare because it had become so politicized and so much of a beltway bandit money grub and a money grab for contracts. It was not what we had originally created. We had created what we believed, and I think everybody still does, an open forum to discuss new ideas and, again, unpopular concepts as we were building out this whole thing called the internet and what was the bad downside going to be. So I got disgusted with what was happening in D.C. and backed out of it and, you know, sold it and moved on to other things.
That's always an interesting story of how, you know, you grow it, you sell it, and then the lawsuits come. Then you're like, it gets disrupted, and then you create something new. And
yeah,
the world just seems to not buy into the concept of having something good remain.
Well, you know, it's more about having disruptive ideas. If you go to conferences today, and I'm going to say this is true in most cases, and they've become vendor pitches. They've become self-interested financial technology. Next generation is going to fix it all. And that was never what I was interested in. I was interested in novel ideas, unexplored thoughts, anything from the improbable to the impossible and somewhere in between to see how multiculturalism and interdisciplinarianism would be able to create new stuff. And that fell apart when it became all about business and money.
Yeah, so I hate to say this, but money seems to drive the world. I don't think that's a great surprise to you.
Oh, no, it is not. I mean, I am very comfortable with my prior naivete. I am very comfortable with my current naivete of not selling to big companies and becoming their spokesman. It was never really for me and still isn't about the money. It's about ideas and thinking and shaking people up a little bit. And I'm very comfortable with that. I didn't need to make $1 billion.
Yeah, but you can only do that.
Never on my radar.
You can only do that as long as you have enough money to get along yourself.
Oh, granted. I mean, you still got to work your ass off to get things done. Absolutely. And it's not given to you. And yeah, I mean, there were consulting contracts. And then the security awareness company came along, which allowed me to hire some incredible people to do things better than I could do. And allow me some luxury to be able to continue doing unpopular things.
Okay, so it's fascinating. He starts the idea of the conference by saying, let's do something, you do all the work and put in the investment and I'll make money out of it. And then he says, no, but it really wasn't about money.
Yeah, well, the end of that conversation, right? You know, at the end of the day, economics are a thing. Everybody's got to eat. You know, if you want to do something and it's not free and you're not paying for it yourself, you know, the money's got to come from somewhere. right? And this is, as we talked about in a previous segment, you know, I disappointed is the wrong word, right? You know, I'm disappointed in myself for not figuring out this early in my own career, but, you know, the, again, Terry Pratchett puts it really well. You know, some people are really good with mechanisms, not that good with economics. Economics is just another set of mechanisms. You know, policy hacking is just hacking. And, you know, as far as InfoWarCon and each of these sort of artifacts that you know, become popular and go through those sort of phases, right? You know, it's the rock band thing, right? You know, the Beatles can't go back and play Liverpool again like they, you know, like they did when they were teenagers.
Yeah, if they tried, if somebody tried today and they were everything that they were then, they would not succeed.
Times move on. Conditions change.
Having said that, if you look over the course of his career, one after another, after another, after another, successful things. So one of the things Wynn seems to be able to do and seems to have done really well is engage with other people and get those collaborations to work, get them to scale to some point, and then get to an exit. And this is one of the things that is really hard to do in the entrepreneurial world. And he's been very successful at it. Having said that, I know nothing about his personal finances, but I know that he's doing just fine. And when you look at this, this issue with 400,000 or 500,000 copies of this book that people paid to make, and I talked to him about this before, you know, he sent this off to overseas or somewhere just to print these things for next to nothing each. Massive volumes of them all given away. He would have been a millionaire many times over by just getting a $1 royalty on each of those books. But he instead helped 500,000, maybe 1 million children and their teachers and their families better understand the ethics of the internet.
Right, you know, and beyond subsistence, you know, there's what are you trying to achieve, right? You know, and it, you know, again, we talk boats all the time. And, you know, a friend recently was talking about one of their founders, CEOs, and so forth, having a 70-foot yacht in Miami, multiple houses, right? You know, I specifically want to not have a 70-foot yacht. You know,
yeah,
I
mean, not for me.
I got to think about it. I got to have a staff on board all the time. Got to manage all that, or hire somebody to manage that, manage them managing that. Like, you know, wealth. Don't get me wrong. You know, poverty sucks, right? You know, but you know, wealth is. You know, welcome back to the hippie hour. Is, are you happy? Can you lay in your bed, you know, when you're passing away in your last day and say, yeah, that worked pretty well, right? And it adds up to a lot of these things. Beyond a certain point, cash is just a tool.
When you think about some of the extremely wealthy, extremely famous people in the world today, and the extent to which ego plays into the game and all this stuff, none of them seem to me to be all that happy, right? They seem like they're struggling for something. And it's never enough. And somehow
and maybe we all are, you know, we're all mortals, you know, coming to an end, you know, what we really all want is immortality, not getting that. So short of that, what is it? I try not to judge too much. You know, I know some very wealthy people who are actually in fact quite happy, right? You know, but I think it's the, you know, it's that middle range, or when you feel you're in the middle range, but you're going for the top, right? You know, and if it's just economics, if it's just money, you know, good luck. You may not get there.
Well, but
you
can
have a fantastic life anyways. Yeah, something to measure. One of the happiest, you know, I like to call it a lot of people, Willie Callahan, Willie in South Carolina, literally landscaper Willie. You know, a guy had a, you know, a 4.0 GPA in the late 60s and decided, you know, went to medical school, didn't want to be a doctor, and sailed around the world on an oil tanker, worked at a nuclear facility, and then taught me landscaping because he was a landscaper at Greenville Tech, South Carolina. Right. And a happier man I have yet to meet. Right. You know, huge money. No. I mean, would he want it? I don't know. Probably give it away. You know, he's got a nice little shotgun shack house, an audio file system. Fantastic. And now he's retired. Damn good life. I don't know a lot of very rich people who've had as good a life as Willie.
So achieving happiness. Now we are the cyber show.
Cyber.
So how. But besides the indirect effects of it being involved in it somehow, making money or whatever off of it, you know, I think there's a good argument to be made that cyber has made many, many people much happier and healthier and live longer and have better lives.
Well, right. And let's talk about the social media in the room, right? You know, everybody's angsting about this right now, the downsides of, you know, pick a platform, the way it's used, misinformation, disinformation, people spending too much time, blah, blah, blah. Now, at the same time, you don't have to walk a mile across the field to talk to your neighbor, right? You know, humans like to communicate. It's kind of our thing. you know, this whole internet, you know, and social media and so forth. I think mostly what we don't have is the, you know, demographic social skills, right? You know, how do I use this thing? You know, we're wired for the pub, right? The school, you know, the council meeting or some way that people used to get together. Now we can get together all the time. So it's not a bad thing. It's fantastic that we can get together that much. And yes, it comes with these downsides. So,
yeah, you're talking about social media, which is only one very narrow focus. I mean, how about all of the improvements to medicine, right? All the improvements to, you know, when we were young, when I was young, certainly, you could not start a car reliably.
Right.
You had to, you know, pull out the choke and push on the gas a little bit and turn the key and the ground a little bit. And it was colder. You had to do something different. And, you know, nowadays you get in the car and you push the button and it bloody starts. I mean, every time.
Well, you know, just this week saw something I've been waiting for since childhood. My dad's working at IBM. You know, I'm a little kid, think about computers and things. And I've seen something on the news or whatever about, you know, medical tests, you know, urine, you know, peeing and so forth. And I think, oh, do they have something? Our toilets? You know, can a computer just read a toilet and tell if I'm sick?
Oh, there is one out on the internet now that you can buy.
Right, right. And all my life,
yeah, yeah.
And people are like, no, I don't want that. It's like, yes, you do. Yeah, I mean,
well, some people like, do.
I think everybody does. Would you like to know, you know, the moment you have, for example, precancerous cells in your urine, or would you like to find out 18 months later when there's a lump? Yeah, door A, please, door A. Everybody wants this, right? But it's a social funny thing because, you know, talking about, you know, toilets, it gets you a laugh. But it's like, actually, no, that's the reason, right? So, yep.
So I just think, you know, it's astonishing how beneficial it has been and how it's driven every aspect of technology in our lives and all of the incredible good things about it. And then you see things like cyber war and the social media and the changing of the social environment and so forth, and maybe the destruction of systems of government and governance. And, you know, I'm not sure what's coming next. I mean, people say, well, it's going to be autocracy and they prefer democracy. The statement is democracy is the worst form of government except all the others, right?
Right, right.
But maybe there's another one. Maybe there are other ones that are going to be better that are coming, and maybe the enablement of humanity by the cyber environment is a path to that. And I don't want to cut that off. At the same time, I am not a big fan of lies and deception. But you know what? Influence has been education. That's how we got a common set of values in the United States at the end of World War II and thereafter that brought us to the forefront of the world in many ways as a country. It came from influence operations, from a consistent limited message. And clearly in that time frame, it disadvantaged lots of people. And now they're saying, no, it might have been good for you, but it wasn't that good for me. And so this future that the more information to more people from more places is bringing, you know, might be something that's much better for everybody, might be disadvantaged to some. But whatever this path forward is, people are living longer. It's easier to do many things. The pandemic has been much, much better, more survivable because of it. You know, this, the ability to get the things you need to continue living at home, improvements in transportation, and the movement towards local transportation and quadcopters and other means of things that are less damaging to the environment. And the list is endless, the benefits that it's bringing.
Yeah, you mentioned the pandemic. You know, I'm a very, very social person. And I've worked remotely for 30 years, but I also travel a lot, right? You know, like getting together with people and talking to people is different, right? And, you know, just taking the available technology, cranking it up a little bit. You know, the first year of the pandemic, you know, when we were living in Ontario in Canada, I took a little garage, turned into an office with 7 screens, a projection monitor, microphones everywhere else, so I could hang out with my friends. I couldn't hang out with them.
Yeah, and it wasn't the same.
But it was a hell of a lot better by myself.
Yeah, think about how tough it would have been without this.
Right.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Our next All.net members forum will be at 11 o'clock that same day. To attend, sign up to our mailing list through thecybershow.co.
On Tuesday, March 14th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors and get a listing in A2E's global directory, a pitch to our global investment community, a slot on the Cyber Show, and an investor follow-on call. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Sin flies through a broken glass ceiling. Peter pops the cherry. Architecture. Julie gets into Medicare frauds. Brian shares his royal T-network. And Wynn has another vision and enters the sixth domain. This and lots more on next week's Cyber Show.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.